If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, equal housing lender, MLS 112-4061.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to Paul Listick Behind the Curtain, our opportunity to take a look at the theater and the arts and the classics of comedy, and we're going to do that today. Now, I know you're kind of wondering, why am I wearing sunglasses? Well, they're not my sunglasses, but they are sunglasses to somebody who, depending on your level of fandom, you might look and say, I kind of know who those were. These belonged to Lucille Ball. These were her actual sunglasses that she would wear all the time out in public. I own them, along with all sorts of other Lucy things, which you probably know out there. But that all aside, we are talking today about a brand new book that came out called Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television. And joining me is its author, Todd Purdom. Todd is a veteran author and journalist. Todd, you've written books on Rodgers and Hammerstein. I wish we grew up together. I mean, because I just, but you also wrote a book about the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Can I move in with you guys?
California is the place to be, as somebody else said.
I think so. Well, so this book about Desi Arnaz, here's the thing. I am a very well-read person when it comes to all things I Love Lucy. And this is unusual because there's a million books on Lucy, a million books on I Love Lucy. There's even a book on Vivian. And you chose to focus in on Desi Arnaz. The only other book I know of that's really just about him is his autobiography, which he called A Book. Of course, I have a signed copy of that. Let me ask you, what made you decide, of all the things Lucy life, I am going to write about Desi?
Well, Paul, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. When I started pursuing this project in 2020, I had been involuntarily liberated from my job at The Atlantic, and journalism was, you know, collapsing around our ears in the pandemic. So it was a moment in our culture when institutions seemed to be reexamining the lives of people who might have been not fully credited in their own lifetimes. The New York Times was running that series of obituaries of people who had not gotten proper notice when they died in the past. And it struck me that Desi Arnaz was the kind of person whose achievements were, you know, under-celebrated and not as widely known as they should have been. He was the first to give Lucy credit as being the absolute genius that made that show work. But to the end of her life, she was always careful to give him credit as the driving force behind getting the show on the air, keeping it there, and building their television empire. So I reached out to Lucy Arnaz, who was very interested in cooperating because she also felt her father has, over the years, gotten short shrift. And it took a while for things to work out, but I'm very glad they did.
While I have a structured outline, you're saying things that trigger me, so I'm just going to go to a couple of different places. By the way, love Lucy Arnaz. I know she assisted you, her husband Larry Luckinbill. I actually did a two-part interview with Larry when his book came out, his autobiography, so they're lovely people. So you did have a lot of family assistance, which is great. One of the things I found interesting, as you say, you know, Desi didn't get his due. For huge fans like myself and you, I'm kind of like, I kind of always thought he was the brains of the operation. I knew that. But towards the end of the book, when you write about his funeral, this I did not know. You talked about the fact that very few people, maybe 100 people, actually showed up. And it was an eulogy by Milton Berle, I believe, who said...
Danny Thomas.
Sorry. Yes, Danny Thomas.
But he had kind of outlived his own fame and success, partly because the last 25 years of his life were a rather sad spiral down into alcoholism and depression. And he undermined his own stature in the industry by being unable to function, really. But his achievements have lasted and endured. And if you watch television today... especially if you watch a sitcom, you really owe a very large debt to Desi Arnaz and the techniques he pioneered.
You actually talk about the fact that, and I think a lot of people do know, Desi created this three-camera shoot, and he did it. I want to ask you why he did it. But what I didn't know is you talk about a series of different comic sitcoms in the show, some that were single comedy, single camera shots, others triple. It's a world of difference when you're doing the single versus the triple.
In the epilogue of the book, I talk about the enduring legacy of the three-camera sitcom, which Desi pioneered. Actually, the first people to use three cameras were the game show producer, Ralph Edwards, was using it on his Truth or Consequences show. But obviously, that's different than a show with a plot, like a little play. Around the same time I Love Lucy was getting started, Amos and Andy was filming with three cameras. But it was really I Love Lucy that made it the industry standard and that that made it the method that most people use. In the 60s and 70s, some sitcoms began to be shot with a single camera the way a movie is. And in some cases, that was for the convenience of the star. So when Fred McMurray was starring in My Three Sons, he liked to bunch all his work together in a period of a short few weeks so that he could play golf for the rest of the year.
Brian Keith did the same thing with Family Affair.
Yeah. But as the 70s came along, Norman Lear and Grant Tinker at Mary Tyler Moore realized that there was nothing that could beat that live audience reaction, and they reverted to making sort of three camera the norm. There's a fascinating moment about in the first season of Happy Days, they were using just a single camera and the show wasn't quite clicking. And in the second season, Gary Marshall decided to use three cameras and suddenly the ensemble was really cooking and they took fire, caught fire. So I think it's a very interesting fact that 75 years later, this same method, you understand that comedy, three cameras can capture sort of action and reaction in one moment and not depend on recreating that spontaneity that could be lost forever in a comic setup. And I think that's, you know, Desi deserves an enormous amount of credit for being not the inventor of it, but the first person to really make it commercially viable and make it the industry standard.
But it almost sounds like a full circle moment. And what I mean by that is, as you write in the book, television was generally all live, right? I mean, that's the way it was done. So this kind of took us away from live, yet it brings us back to live, adding the camera. And today, so many people like to do that. I mean, this whole live to tape thing is really what I'm referencing.
No, absolutely. And I mean, television was in the early days a live medium, and the liveness of it, the immediacy of it was part of the point. But it was also born of necessity because there was no videotape yet. And the only way to preserve a television program was to film it off a video monitor on something called a kinescope, usually on 16-millimeter film that produced a blurry, not very good quality image that wasn't really suitable for rebroadcast. So by filming I Love Lucy, Desi and Lucy also effectively created the commercial viability of the rerun and syndication sales, which was the model of television for seven decades until streaming came along as a competing paradigm.
The one thing you did in the book, among others, but I'll be honest, when I got the book, I thought, what can you possibly teach me about Lucy and Desi that I don't know? And you probably have a lot of people who say that to you, right?
I mean, I did.
And let me share with you one of those things that I caught. What we get in this is the business part of that entire evolution of the show. And it's really Desi's perspective, because while Lucy eventually buys him out, various things happen, but Desi, in many ways, got the business aspect of this. And that's kind of what made him such a brain in all of this, right? Back then, right? Reruns. No one's ever going to watch a rerun.
No, it's a human story. It's a wonderful story about his life and his youth in Cuba, his losing everything, coming to America, reinventing himself, making himself into a musical star, a band leader, helped popularize the conga dance. But then it is also a business story, and it's a story about the evolution of the early days of television in Hollywood. And frankly, the transformation of Hollywood from, New York had been the center of early television production, and it was Desi Lu and the success of I Love Lucy and the success of filming television programs so that they could be preserved that really brought television to Hollywood, where, after all, you know, the experts in film all were in Hollywood. So once television became a fundamentally filmed medium, it was natural that Los Angeles would be the center of production, and that's what happened.
One of the signs, perhaps, of Desi's brilliance, but maybe also his cunning, maybe not his best side. You write about this in the book, and I've talked to Greg Oppenheimer about this as well, Jess Oppenheimer's son, was the little thing that Desi pulled on Jess Oppenheimer, right? Variety shows up, and it talks about who exactly is producing I Love Lucy, and maybe there was some untruth about what was put in the media.
Yeah, I mean, Jess Oppenheimer was the showrunner, the producer, the head writer of the show when it began, and he filed with the Writers Guild the creation of the character of Lucy Ricardo and Ricky Ricardo, and he deserves enormous credit for shaping the show, for conceiving the basic paradigm of the show. What happened was that as the show became a hit, Desi knew that his own future as a performer in Hollywood was going to be limited, because he'd never quite found his footing in the movies. There was no role that exactly fit this, you know, a guy with a thick accent and some musical talent. So he lobbied to become the producer, executive producer of the show. And he went around Jess Oppenheimer's back and kind of leaked word of it to the trade press in Hollywood. And Oppenheimer thought he'd agreed to it, but the way Desi presented it, it was, somewhat misleading. And this is a theme that when Desi wrote his memoir in the mid-1970s, when he was approaching 60, he felt resentful that he had not gotten the credit he thought he deserved. So in writing that book, as you know from reading it, he tended to overtake credit for things that were actually a team effort. And it upset Jess Oppenheimer that if you read Desi's book, you would never know that I Love Lucy had any producer other than Desi Arnaz, which is distinctly not true. And Greg Oppenheimer was a huge help to me in writing this book. He read the chapters involving the creation of I Love Lucy and saved me from a number of infelicitous errors by his expertise. He's taken on his father's legacy. He was a lawyer, a working lawyer in Los Angeles, and he's now become a playwright and producer and a chronicler of television's early days.
One of the things you also write about at the end of it was just 3 days or so after Desi passes, the Kennedy Center honors Lucy. And there she is up. And I've seen these clips, so many people have, and Reagan's there, whatever. But here's the thing. Talk about, there's a speech read that were Desi's words. And in that speech, he actually says, "I'm often asked who gets credit for I Love Lucy. 90% of it goes to Lucy." So where did he see himself fitting in?
Well, I think he saw himself as the person who kept the wheels running. Madeline Pugh, one of the writers of I Love Lucy, to me summed it up very well, in which she described the success of the show as relying on the fact that Lucy would do anything they could dream up, no matter how zany or risky or physically demanding, and Desi would pay for it. And Desi was apparently the sort of producer who never asked, like, how much is this going to cost? He's the one who said, if you think it's funny and this will work, then we'll try to make it happen. There's a famous story about how in the episode when they're fishing and they're manhandling big tunas, initially there were rubber fish. And he decided these were not realistic enough. They did not look right. So he sent somebody down to the harbor in San Pedro in Los Angeles, and they came back with two giant, real, stinky, slippery tunas. That was what they insisted. When Lucy bakes the giant loaf of bread, it was really a great big loaf of bread that had been baked by a local bakery. So I think he was very conscious that his role was to support Lucy. There's a story about how once she tripped over a cable on the soundstage, and he told his colleagues, "Look, amigos, anything happens to her, we'll all in the shrimp business."
You write towards the end of the prologue of the book. You basically make the comment, a lot of people loved Lucy. A lot of people loved Lucille, but pretty much only Desi loved Lucy.
Yes, she had really been known her whole life by her friends and her family and early days in Hollywood. She was known as Lucille, and it was Desi who gave her the diminutive Lucy, which is a kind of a soft Spanish-sounding name. He then named their daughter Lucy with an I-E, and combining his name and hers, the middle name Lucy Desiree. And I think that he was proprietary about her. He was 6 years younger, and he was going to make the point that she had a life before him, but they were starting a new life together and had a kind of a new name together. And they moved into their ranch house, which they christened Desi Lou, a combo of their names, which then became their production company, of course.
What many people may not know is that they had a divorce before the famous divorce. And I'm going to ask my guest, Todd Purdom, what it is I'm referring to when we come back on Paul Listening Behind the Curtain after these words. Stay with us. And we are back here on Paul Listening Behind the Curtain. We're talking about a brand new book that just came out called Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television. If you are at all a Lyle of Lucy fan, a Lucy Desi fan, anything, you need to read this book. It's just part of the mandatory reading that you must do. And its author, Todd Purdom, veteran journalist and author, is with me. So Todd, before the break, I had mentioned that we all know about the famous divorce around 1960 that happens at the end of the Lucy Desi Comedy Hour. But you actually write about the fact that, well, very early on, there was another divorce, but most people may not know about that.
Yes, in the middle of World War II, Desi was stationed in the Army at a hospital and stateside camps. And he was not being faithful to Lucy, and she got so fed up with it that she filed for divorce. But the night before her court appearance, they got together and wound up in bed. And that, under California law, invalidated the preliminary decree. So they got back together, And then they ultimately renewed their vows in a Catholic ceremony. And Lucy eventually, after that, got pregnant with their daughter, Lucy. And that's, they started I Love Lucy because they wanted to be together, work together in Los Angeles, keep Desi at home and off the road, which was an opportunity for him to philander. And it's a paradox that, you know, I Love Lucy was born of an effort to save their marriage.
And also interesting because the producers, the sponsors, really, they said they didn't want Desi in the role as the husband, right? Because who's going to believe that this woman is married to this Cuban bandleader guy? And I believe she said, I am married to the Cuban bandleader.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
Right. So they took the show on the road to test it, including right here in Chicago.
Yes, they came to the Chicago Theater, I believe, and they did a vaudeville act before movies. Desi came up with the idea that if audiences around the country could actually see them together, could see the chemistry, Lucy would do comedy, Desi would do music, that they would accept them. And he was ahead of the suits in this regard. He was ahead of the gatekeepers. He had a palpable sense that the public would go for this team, and they did.
Lucy would change over the, the show would change over the years. I mean, those first couple of seasons, we get just, you know, zany things happening and she thinks he's going to kill her, all this kind of stuff. But at some point, things get to be a little tired. And so they have to come up with these ideas. Let's send him to Hollywood. We'll have adventures on the way. Let's send him to Europe. Did the show hold up in terms of ratings throughout those changes in those seasons?
Yes, it waxed and waned a little bit. And the hour-long episodes that aired after 1957 were never quite the same rating sensation that the half-hour shows had been. But by and large, for the better part of the 1950s, the world of I Love Lucy was the number one show on the air.
By the way, classic point you make, I didn't know this, which is when they did the first episode of the hour-long Lucy Desi Comedy Hour, it was more than an hour. It was 75 minutes, and CBS said, no, not happening. And what did Desi do?
Well, the next program on the lineup was the U.S. Steel Hour, and Desi went to U.S. Steel and said, I'll pay for the extra 15 minutes and I'll introduce your program if you just give us the extra 15 minutes because we like the show at 75 minutes. We don't want to have to cut it. And somebody pointed out that, you know, only in America could this entertainment executive get a major corporation like U.S. Steel to change its ways. They suggested that maybe he should negotiate with the Russians and try to, you know. So that's a sign of Desi's, both his skill and his perspicacity and not taking no as the final answer. If he faced an obstacle, he often found a way around it.
You also wrote, interestingly, in that deal, he also offered to come back on with like a minute before it ended to introduce the next show for them. And he got a car out of the deal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he didn't miss a chance. I mean, he was a pretty savvy guy.
A lot of the stars, Bill Holden, people remember the Hollywood episode, John Wayne, how do you get all of these people to do it? These people would make thousands and thousands of dollars for any kind of appearance. But you write, for Lucy and Desi, they did it for scale.
They did it for scale. And remember in those days still, Paul, movie stars were reluctant in most cases to go on television and diminish their drawing power, their earning power. So they do it for scale and they do it. Inevitably, there was always a promotional element of an upcoming movie project that they had. So William Holden was promoting The Country Girl, which he was starring in with Grace Kelly and Bing Crosby. I forget what movie John Wayne was promoting, but Desi Lu very cannily, persuaded these stars to come on in exchange for basically free promotional activity.
And to do crazy things they probably would never have thought.
Exactly. And because Lucy was Lucy, who wouldn't want to be on the number one show on the air and be part of a cultural, you know, icon and a phenom.
How did Lucy, I mean, she was a, most people know her as a B-level actress, right? Doing those kinds of films. And she has these other breaks in radio, My Favorite Husband, whatever. But was she always going to be that star? What was it that took her to this huge stardom?
Well, I think one thing, Desi. Desi realized that she had this skill and that she could thrive in this comedy environment. What really began to change for her in that regard was in the 1940s when she was under contract to MGM. She became a mentee of the great silent comedian Buster Keaton, who at that point was at the studio kind of marking time. They'd given him a job. They sort of put him in a few movies. He never achieved the brilliant heights of his silent days. But he told Lucy how much props could be her friend. He and another director named Eddie Sedgwick and Eddie Bazell, they saw in her these skills, and they all had come from the world of silent movies. They saw what a brilliance she had with physical comedy. By all accounts, Lucille Ball was not that funny in person. She wasn't a good teller of jokes. She'd get tangled up in the punchline, lose the thread. But if she was telling you a story that she could act out with gestures and voices, and, you know, that's when she shone. And at some level, Desi recognized that about her, and the Lucy character was tailor-made for her great skills.
Fans at least want me to ask you a question about Fred and Ethel Mertz, right? Vivian Vance, William Frawley. So let me do that. The typical, you write about this. I didn't think about this until you wrote it. But in the typical kind of sitcom like that, when there's the other couple, the neighbor, the whoever it is, they're generally a younger couple. And you would talk about that here. And it looks like it was Desi's idea to do something very different, including a significant age difference between the neighbors themselves. And boy, Vivian and William Frawley sure didn't get along.
Yeah, and that's the one thing. I mean, I Love Lucy, by all accounts, was a very happy show, very happy set. The writer's room was happy. There was a lot of harmony. But Vivian Vance and William Frawley really did not like each other. She did not like having to play the wife of a much older, grumpy guy like Frawley. Frawley had what we call minimum high regard for Vivian Vance's talents as a singer and an actress. He was born in Burlington, Iowa. He'd been in vaudeville. He'd come up through, you know, show business over many years. And it was just obviously at some level, the personal distaste they had for each other carried over into the chemistry between Fred and Ethel, who were also always a little bit at war. So it worked, but I think that was the one aspect of the show that was probably personally unhappy for the two.
And Desi took a chance. Frawley was known to be a drinker and all that, and basically gave him the three strikes and you're out rule.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, the sad irony of that is that it was Desi's drinking that ultimately became a problem. Frawley apparently got through all the years of the show, never missing a show, never missing his mark. He was a demon drinker, and he also didn't want to know anything except the lines that he was responsible for saying. So he didn't always understand why something he just said was funny because it had been set up a few pages before. Obviously, it was a dream cast in the end, and a dream ensemble. They fit together so well that's why we're still enjoying them, you know, all these years later.
And yet there is tension on the set. I mean, in the latter years of the show, certainly other episodes of the show, Lucy and Desi weren't talking to each other. Desi would sort of say something and she would sort of respond. I mean, it was very difficult. Did the live audiences pick up on that kind of thing between them?
My sense is probably not too much, because once the camera started rolling, once they were on the set, they could still, even in the very last episode when their marriage was completely falling apart, there's a tender scene between them, and they could, you know, get it together for the audience. But they did, as their marriage crumbled, they would have, you know, would you please tell Mr. Arnaz that I will do that? You know, they would talk through intermediaries, and it sounded like it was pretty tense scene.
They created these characters, and they knew how to get into those characters and leave Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz behind.
Yes, I mean, one of the things, Paul, they were meta before we had the idea of meta. I mean, their real-life marriage carried over into the show, which carried back into their public image. So I think one of the reasons the public embraced them so much, there was this kind of overtone and overhang in which life imitated art, imitated art, imitated life. There was a synergy between what everybody... And the other thing that was always true in the show was that Desi and Lucy had a real, obvious, physical, palpable chemistry, and their characters did too. And, you know, when they kissed each other, they kissed like they meant it. And the public, you know, the viewers understood that. There was always a spark between them.
Not only was always a spark, but even on his deathbed, when they had their final conversation, it's I love you, I love you, I love you. They were always each other's first and, would you say, only love.
I think they were the greatest loves of each other's life. Yes, no doubt about it. And no one before or after ever came close to matching their place in their hearts. And nor did they, either one of them, ever achieve alone or afterwards anything approaching the artistic achievement that they had managed to achieve together. They were unique in their combination, and at some level they knew it.
There's so much more I want to talk to you about, Todd, because, I mean, everything from Tallulah Bankhead replacing Betty Davis and Orson Welles not moving out of the house and Desi and the Mothers-in-Law show. There's so much to talk about. Can you hang on with me, because we're going to have to wrap this show, but if you can hang on sure. Our WGN radio podcast starting on Monday morning, we can have a bonus conversation. Can you do that with me?
Absolutely.
I appreciate that, then. For those of you watching us here on WGN Plus, thanks for watching us here on Paul Listening Behind the Curtain. But Monday morning, tune in to WGNRadio.com and catch the bonus conversation with my guest, Todd Purdom. Pick up a copy of his book, Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television. See you next time. Hi there, and we are back now with a bonus conversation with Todd Purdom, the author of Desi Arnaz, the man who invented television so many times, as we've been talking about on the TV end of this, Todd. People focus in on Lucy and the show. Your focus is the magnificence of Desi Arnaz. Let me focus in a little bit on Desi in terms of the family life. For whatever he was, the cheating and the drinking and all that he did, he loved his kids and he was a family man.
Oh, yes. He was a good father. They say he was a loving father. He was a loving husband. He just was. He had the Latin man's idea of that point in the mid 20th century of, you know, infidelities with meaningless pickups or, you know, prostitutes should mean nothing to his love for his wife. Both his father and grandfather had, you know, strayed from their marriage, and his grandfather had a completely separate household with another set of children and another woman. So he learned, he came by it honestly. It's the culture he grew up in. Lucy never really was okay with that, but she could tolerate it until, and as the 50s wore on, it became glaringly public. It made it into the tabloids. Desi got arrested weaving drunkenly down a street in Hollywood that was known for its bordellos. And that just became too humiliating for her to tolerate. But
you also wrote, by the way, weren't the cops nice to him? They said something like, we could have arrested him in the bordello, but we didn't.
Yes. I mean, you know, yes. And then he embarrassed himself by calling out for his friend J. Edgar Hoover. And, you know, so yes. But apparently the cops would take pity on him. And when he'd be drunk, they'd quietly return him to this back door of his house in Beverly Hills rather than arrest him for public drunkenness. And I suspect he surely must have, you know, driven drunk and not been arrested. And, you know, Beverly Hills particularly was a much smaller town in those days. There was a kind of protection racket going on for the movie stars. Their studios and their publicity people helped them out of scrapes. The cops covered up things. So he benefited from that. There's no doubt.
I once had the joy. I was friends with Kay Ballard, and had the joy of staying at her Palm Springs home, which was Desi's home.
Which had once been Desi's home.
Yeah. And so that was such a treat to sort of spend overnight. She'd tell me the stories and all the crazy things. And for some reason, she had oranges in the back of the neighborhood. And I thought, well, you know, the orange episode, I'm taking an orange from Desi's actual backyard. It meant something to me at the time. But I do want to talk to you about, you mentioned J. Edgar Hoover. There was an actual very, really scary moment in their life when, you know, McCarthy and those folks decided that Lucy was a communist. And the truth is she actually was, but the story is just not what the government was making it up to be.
Yeah, her father had died when she was 3.5 years old, and she was raised, her father figure was her maternal grandfather, a guy named Fred Hunt. And she called him daddy. And he was an old line American socialist, a furniture maker in Jamestown, New York. And when Lucy got her start in Hollywood, she moved her family there to join her. And in 1936, Grandpa Hunt asked them all to register on the communist line, which they did. And nobody paid any attention to this until many years later in the 1950s when the Red Scare was in full swing. And somehow the House Un-American Activities Committee got wind of this and called Lucy in for private secret testimony, in which she explained that, you know, in the middle of the Depression, registering communists wasn't too much worse than being a Republican. And, you know, somehow it leaked to Walter Winchell. He had a blind item on his radio show one Sunday night. And then it went into the Los Angeles newspapers, and it threatened, you know, to derail their careers, because careers in Washington and Hollywood were being ruined at this point. If you'd had any association in the past, not just with communism, but with even leftist causes in the run up to World War II. So Desi reached out to their friend, J. Edgar Hoover, whom he'd known from the Del Mar racetrack down by San Diego, and to the congressman involved on the committee, and got him to hold a news conference exonerating Lucy. And they were taping the first show of the third season of I Love, filming the first show of the third season.
Which was only by the dress store,
That night, exactly. And Lucy was terribly worried about how the studio audience would react. And Desi introduced her by saying, you know, here's my wife, the mother of my children, my favorite redhead. That's the only thing about her that's red is her hair, and even that's not legitimate. And the audience erupted in affectionate applause, said, we love you, Lucy. And the next day's papers, basically, it all turned out to be sort of a tempest in a teapot. But to the end of her life, Lucy was scarred enough by the episode that she never again voted.
Yeah, you wrote that. I did. That's something I didn't know. And that was fascinating to me. You opened the book with, to me, it's a famous clip. It's when Lucy and Desi appear on Toast of the Town with Ed Sullivan, and he gets up and he gives a speech. And I wanted to ask you about that, because what he talks about during that little emotional speech, he gets very emotional. He talks about cleaning bird cages and the life of growing up. And yet there is the flip side. His father was the mayor of the town in Cuba. So are they aristocrats? Are they put? What were they?
Oh, yes, they were aristocrats, Paul. He'd grown up as a prince in Cuba. His father was the mayor of Santiago, the second largest city. His mother's father was an executive at the Bacardi Rum Company. But in the 1933 Cuban Revolution, when the American-backed regime of Gerardo Machado, which had grown repressive and corrupt, was overthrown, they had to flee to Florida with basically nothing in their pockets. And Desi bought a $5 guitar and reinvented himself as a musician. But when he was in high school, to earn money, he got a job cleaning bird cages in a chain of local drugstores. And in that clip on the with Ed Sullivan, he reflects very emotionally, as you say, that only in America could he have had the chance that he had. And it's important to remember that he wasn't just an immigrant. He was a refugee. He came here seeking, you know, fleeing political turmoil in his home country. And it's something that these days, you know, it has overtones that I think are very, very current in our current situation, when we have to realize that talent comes in all shapes and sizes and with all sorts of accents. And it's probably something that we need to be aware of.
For those people who love just the I Love Lucy show and the Lucy Desi Comedy Hour, the book is filled with little stories and tidbits all the way through, which are great. I'm just going to pick a couple because I mentioned them on the TV side of this. One was Orson Welles, who was supposed to just live with them for a few weeks, and somehow that became 6 months. I kind of like fish, right? It gets smelly after a while.
Yeah, well, it's like the old play, The Man Who Came to Dinner. They made a deal with Orson Welles to do a pilot about the Fountain of Youth that ultimately didn't get picked up. And they put him up in their guest house in Beverly Hills, and he just wouldn't leave. He was one of the great you know, characters of all time. In later years, he wound up, as you probably know, living with Peter Bogdanovich, the director. So I think, you know, they might have regretted the moment they opened their door.
And the other story I mentioned earlier was that Bette Davis, I mean, I've seen the Tallulah Bankhead Comedy Hour a million times. It wasn't supposed to be Tallulah Bankhead. It was supposed to be Bette Davis.
Yeah, the plot involved the Ricardos living in Connecticut, and they get a celebrity moving in next door. It was originally going to be Bette Davis, and she'd agreed to do it for a very high price. I forget exactly what it was. And
it's $20,000.
Something like that, an airfare home to Maine. And but she fell and injured herself, and she had to drop out. So they got Tallulah Bankhead instead, which was a big adventure because she was a larger-than-life character who apparently during most of the week's rehearsals was drunk the whole time, and they weren't sure they could get a performance out of her. And then on the night of the filming of the show, she was letter perfect, which so rattled Lucy and Desi that they missed a few of their lines. But it worked out okay.
You also said there was like a staff meeting or something, and typically the guest wouldn't be there, and Tallulah just walks in and goes, "Here I am."
Well, they had a meeting in which they wanted to talk about what the heck are we going to do with this crazy star? And she showed up unannounced, uninvited. And then Lucy admired her sweater and she took it off. And whereupon Vivian Vance said, "It's a good thing you did admire her pants." And then she took off her pants. And there's a mixed memories about exactly what she was wearing under her clothes. But the meeting came to an abrupt end and they all agreed that they'd just do the best they could, I guess.
The very final episode was with Ernie Kovacs and Edie Adams. And I guess when you're of a certain age, Edie Adams actually was a friend of mine, and I produced a show with her here in Chicago. So we had many a conversation. And it was well known that the Lucy-Desi relationship was over, headed to divorce as they were doing that final show. You mentioned earlier on the TV side the fact that there were, you know, even affectionate moments between Lucy and Desi in that show. Lucy knew she was the very next morning she was going to court to file for the divorce. Did Desi know that as well?
I think so. He had to have known that. And Edie Adams has this wonderful, poignant recollection about how Lucy was obviously so on edge that she made Edie Adams redo her hair like three times. He wasn't satisfied with it. And Edie Adams sings the beautiful Dick Haynes song, "That's All," which is, of course, a metaphor for what was happening in real life. And when Lucy and Desi have their final kiss, as they both said, it summed up, you know, 20 years of marriage and ups and downs in their life, but a great deal of you know, affection that couldn't be hidden.
You mentioned earlier as well how Desi would sort of spend money when they needed to, like the fish and getting the big fish. But there's also a little story that goes along with the U.S. Constitution. I have some of the silverware from the USS Constitution before they destroyed it. But nevertheless, I mean, I will admit too that even I would when I first saw these things, goes, they're not on a soundstage anymore. They rented a boat. But talk about what they did.
Well, they were the masters of cross promotion and, you know, marketing. So they got American Export Lines, which owned the Constitution, to help finance the creation of a very realistic looking set that would mimic the ship. And then, of course, that they filmed real scenes of Lucy landing on a helicopter. You know, the plot is that she's missed the boat and has to catch up with it. It was so realistic to American audiences that people wrote the ship company asked when it was going to land in England. And in fact, that particular line went from New York to Genoa in Italy. It didn't even go to England at all. So, it seemed so real that people thought this was, you know, they ought to book tickets themselves.
Also, you know, let's move beyond the show and all that. The production of other shows, I believe Lucy, for example, had to decide at one time, do we put our money behind Star Trek? Or I'm drawing a blank on, I want to say Mission Impossible, but it was the other show.
Those were the two.
Okay, with Star Trek.
She went with both. I mean, after they divorced, and Lucy was running the company, 1966, there were two pilots in development, and her business advisor said, these shows are going to be very expensive to produce. They're going to be cash flow negative. If you greenlight them, you're going to have to sell the studio because any rewards will be down in the future. And Gary Morton, apparently her second husband, liked the shows. Lucy believed in them. So she approved them. And then the year later, she sold the studio to Paramount, which ever since has been reaping, you know, billions of dollars in rewards from those two franchises, Star Trek and Mission Impossible.
Desi wasn't unsuccessful because he was responsible, as you write, for The Untouchables. Yeah. And of course, The Mothers. A lot of people don't seem to remember The Mothers-in-Law show. I do.
I do too. I watched it in real time on Sunday nights. And if you knew Kay Ballard, you obviously knew what a live wire she was as a
Absolutely.
Singer and comedian. You know, started on Broadway.
And the stories we could tell each other.
Introduced a number of, she introduced Lazy Afternoon, that beautiful song from Broadway. So I had a soft spot in my heart for that show. And of course, it was sort of a family affair. Eve Arden had been a co-star with Lucy way back in her RKO days. She'd done Our Miss Brooks for Jessie Liu. It had its moments. It wasn't pioneering. It wasn't path-breaking. It didn't, you know, break any new ground, but it was an appealing, it lasted for two seasons. And that was really the last thing that Desi managed to get on the air. It was the last kind of project that he really could muster the discipline to.
There's so much in the book. We're not even, I mean, for folks who are watching us, I don't have to read this book. Yeah, you do. We are not even touching on a tenth of what is in this book, but I want to just at least introduce people to some other things to say, does he write about this? And you do write about the movie career, the long, 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 long trailer and Forever Darling, at which Forever Darling, not a big hit, but I love the story with regard to Long, Long, Long Trailer, which I love, where they walked into a screening of it. This huge ovation goes on and Lucy thought it was for Eleanor Roosevelt or somebody else in the theater.
Yeah, they're promoting the movie. They take a trip to New York. They go to see a Broadway play, and suddenly people are standing up in the auditorium around them. And Lucy thinks a celebrity, Mrs. Roosevelt or someone, must be in the theater. And they realize it's for them. And they're seeing Tea House of the August Moon, and David Wayne is playing a Japanese character. And the ovation is so long that it interrupts the thing, and he has to come to the lip of the stage and say, "We love Russi too." And and it's, you know, they were. A cultural phenom that's hard to a degree that's hard to fathom now, at a point when, you know, 30 million people watch their show every week in a country of 150 or 160 million people.
By the way, David Wade, who went on to play the Mad Hatter in Batman, could never say what he did that night today. That is not politically correct.
No. Yeah.
Could not do that. And Lucy, of course, everybody knows, went on to do other shows that Desi was involved with. And so many mutual friends, Ann Southern and people that got involved. But as it goes on in her career, his career moves away from the performing and all of that. He's into the business world, but they always remain tied. And he always knew what it would take for Lucy to be a success as well.
Yes, he helped get her second series, The Lucy Show, off the air and directed the early episodes of it. It just became too hard for them to continue working together. And also his alcoholism by that point was so out of control that he was, you know, falling asleep on the set and really dysfunctional in his daily work life. But they never lost that connection. As you said, at his dying day, they were talking just days before he died. And she relied on him for business advice for the rest of his life.
I'm curious, as I wrap up with you, you know, at the end of their life, I want to get your sense of Desi. You know, when I interviewed Lucy Arnaz once for the show, and I asked her, I had read that Lucille Ball always felt that at the end of the life, because of her last show, which was just such a failure, that she felt nobody loved her anymore. Nobody cared about her anymore. And that really broke my heart to hear that, because, of course, as you remember, when she did pass, the reaction publicly was incredible and amazing. And I asked Lucy whether or not that was true, whether or not her mother really thought that. And she said yes. She knew people loved her, but it was true that she felt she had, my words, had kind of fallen out a favor with a lot of the people. And that just couldn't have been further from the truth. What was Desi? Do you have a sense of what Desi's thought was about how people viewed him at the end?
Well, you know, I think in both cases, they knew that they were both, in a sense, trapped by the success, by the enormous success of I Love Lucy, because Lucy was afraid that the public would not accept her in any other role than this kind of zany Lucy character. So her last ill-considered, ill-fated series, Life with Lucy, she was a grandma approaching 80 doing these physical stunts, and people were sort of afraid she was going to get hurt. So she, you know, Lucy never got to have on Golden Pond in the way that Henry Fonda did.
Yeah,
and
good point.
I think she would have been perfectly capable of playing a very moving, good, dramatic role, or a role that blended drama and comedy. She just never got that chance. I think also Gary Morton was involved in managing her career at that point, and he was not very creative, or, you know, he didn't have an enormous good taste necessarily, or with it. And they were sort of risk averse, and she was just, you know, collecting her life achievement awards. But yeah, I think Desi knew that he'd been appreciated. And when his accountant recalled how when he would go out, even in as he was, you know, running out of money, he'd still feel he had to put on the dog and rent a limousine and, you know, be a kind of mogul star. And he appeared on the first season of Saturday Night Live doing, among other things, his conga routine at the end. And
you write about that. You sort of said the show comes up short. He ends up. You said one of the stars thought he was going to die of a heart attack doing the conga.
Yeah, Al Franken told me that the show was short and that Desi had to fill time with a conga line at the end of the show, and they were afraid he was drumming so vigorously, they were afraid he might have a heart attack. You know, there's a poignant story in that, which I didn't know when I wrote the book. I found it in the new book about Lorne Michaels, the new biography of Lorne Michaels, which is that when Desi was the guest host of that episode of Saturday Night Live, he asked to be put up at the Waldorf Astoria, which was not the usual hotel for Saturday Night Live. And Lorne Michaels agreed and thought it was kind of, you know, obnoxious. But he later learned that it was because when Desi had been in Xavier Cugat's band in the 1930s, he had to go in through the servants' entrance of the hotel. And he just wanted to be able, you know, to go through the main front door and take his room. And so I found that kind of poignant. I suspect he also, it's the risk, Paul, when you live long enough, and he didn't, he only lived to be 69. But if you outlive your fame, or you outlive the moment in which you're the it, you know, topic of pop culture, people don't. I've been interested to learn many younger people today. I take it for granted that everybody knows who Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz were. That's actually not true. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people who are sort of 30 and under, and they really don't have any idea. So I hope if this book can reintroduce them to readers, that will have succeeded, and that will have been achieved one of my goals in doing it.
Well, that's a great way to end with this final question, because I feel the same way. I feel like everybody knows Lucy Desi as they know the Beatles. 50 or 75 years from now, look, it's 75 years or so from when that show came on the air, and we're still talking about it, and many people are. Todd, what is your thought 50 or 75 years from now? Will the younger generation know who Lucy and know all, they may not know all the details of Desi's story as you write them, but will they say, yes, I know who that is, as I do believe they will say with the Beatles and perhaps Frank Sinatra and others?
Well, if Paramount and the people who own the intellectual property, the people who own the rights to Lucy, are canny about it, they will, because the shows can stand on their own. They're like Greek comedy. That, you know, you would never know from watching I Love Lucy that Harry Truman was the president, or the Korean War was going on, or whatever else was happening. They deal with eternal questions of the human condition: love, jealousy, avarice, friendship, betrayal, ambition. Lucy's always trying to break out of her apron strings and get into show business. Desi's always trying to keep her in the house. You can laugh at the greatest of the episodes just as heartily today as you ever did. I mean, we're around the same age, I suspect, and every sick day of my childhood, I remember watching I Love Lucy back to back and syndication in the daytime or the afternoon hours. And So I think if somebody gets a chance to see those shows, first of all, they'll look as crisp and fresh as they ever did because Desi had the foresight to film them. And I think they'll be laughing as long as they have eyes to see and ears to hear.
And one of the great stories, by the way, of course, and I might have a little, correct me here if I'm saying anything wrong, but I believe it was the night of Eisenhower's inauguration where the ratings for I Love Lucy beat the inauguration TV ratings. And in fact, at the party afterwards, correct me if I'm wrong, but even the Eisenhowers, somebody basically, they took a break to go watch I Love Lucy.
Oh, that I'm not sure, but I do know that the episode that aired on January 19th, 1953, the night before Eisenhower's inauguration, which was the birth of little Ricky on the show.
That's what I'm talking about.
And the birth of Desi Arnaz Jr. in real life, the ratings for that exceeded the ratings of noontime the next day when Eisenhower was inaugurated. And years later, when he met Desi Arnaz Jr. in Palm Springs, he said, "Are you the little lad who knocked me off the front pages?" And he bought him a banana split.
See, that's why I love it. I knew I wasn't quite getting it right, but I knew you would get it right. Todd Purdom, the book is called Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television. If you're not a Lucy fan, it'll make you one, and a Desi fan. But thank you for adding to my knowledge. Look, I admit it. I thought I knew everything there was to know about them, but you taught me that I did not. And thank you for sharing so much great information. We're going to put the cover of the book up again so our viewers can see it. It's available on Amazon and especially wherever great books are sold. Todd Purdom, thank you for your time. Congratulations on this. I can't wait to see what you write next. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And thanks for watching us here on Behind the Curtain. We'll see you next time.